sind Theresa und
Nemo
und deshalb sind wir zu Shopify gewechselt.
Die Plattform, die wir vor Shopify verwendet haben, hat regelmäßig Updates gebraucht, die teilweise dazu geführt haben, dass der Shop nicht funktioniert hat.
Endlich macht unser Nemo-Boards-Shop dadurch auch auf den Mobilgeräten eine gute Figur. Und die Illustrationen auf den Boards kommen jetzt viel, viel klarer rüber, was uns ja auch wichtig ist und was unsere Marke auch ausmacht.
Starte deinen Test noch heute für 1 Euro pro Monat auf shopify.de/radio.
This episode of Retronauts is brought to you by Uncommon Goods and Harry's.
This week on Retronauts, we go postal yet again. Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Retronauts. This week's episode is called The Revenge of Listener Comments Catch-Up. As I do more of these listener mail episodes, the titles get more and more complicated. But I am your host, Bob Mackey, who is here with me today, not as always, but pretty often.
Hey, I've tore myself away from Super Mario Wonder to be here. Henry Gilbert, hello.
Yes, we have to savor the Mario Wonder. This is not a 200-hour JRPG. There are precious few bits of Mario content available, and we have to just draw out every ounce of joy from them.
And it's not a Spider-Man game with an entire map full of, like, doodads to pick up and checklists to complete.
Yes, Mario's not unlocking nodes or waypoints or anything like that. I do want to say that we haven't really done a Respond to Listener Comments podcast since episode 354, the Pandemic Mailbag, back in January of 2021. So we're long overdue. And like a little behind the scenes thing, I like to do these every now and then to relieve a little pressure from the burden of being a podcast host, because often podcasts take a very long time to plan. And when I do listener mail episodes, of course, I have to, you know, curate the comments. But you listeners, it's your turn to do most of the work. And that's what's happening this week. You're going to be building the content for this episode, and we'll merely be reading and responding to it. So in the way you're all the hosts, unfortunately, you're unpaid. We can't do anything about that. There'd be too many W-9s and 1099 MISCs to send out. And our taxes are complicated enough as is.
Think of the exposure you listeners are getting on this Retronauts episode, though.
Yes, put it on your LinkedIn. My comment was read on episode 500, whatever this is. And I'm sure every business will open their doors to you. So to kick things off here, I thought we'd give a little personal update as to where we all are right now. This is late October of 2023. And if you're not Talking Simpsons listeners, you might not know that I have relocated to Vancouver. And that's where I'm recording from right now. I've been here for almost 3 months. I love it. But now I have my own Retronauts North studio, so that's where I'm coming from. And Henry is now in the Seattle area, so there are no more Retronauts in the Bay Area, except for Kat Bailey. She's still hanging out there, but we're going to get her out of there. We're going to launch a rescue mission.
I moved here to better stalk the Nintendo of America offices. That's
yes. You should not wear your Mario cap while you're, you know, hanging outside the perimeter of the building.
I stealthily I pulled down the bill so they don't know it's me.
Have you been tempted to go to Redmond, Henry?
No, I haven't. I've been in other areas. If they had an IKEA in Redmond, I would have been there. But no, not yet. But I mean, the Bungie offices are here, the Valve. There's so many offices here. It feels like while every company left San Francisco that wasn't Ubisoft, they're still all here in Seattle.
And, we loved recording together in Berkeley, but now that we are in our own separate locations, I said it before on another podcast, but this is the first time I've ever had a podcasting room, period, in my, I'm in my 13th year of podcasting, so it took over a decade for me to just have a personal podcasting space. That's how bad the real estate market is in the Bay Area. A man can't even afford a podcast room when he podcasts for a living, but now I'm able to be much more productive. We are, we've gotten used to remote recording thanks to COVID, so I think we're in a really good place. So that's just a little personal update in case you're not Talking Simpsons listeners, you're wondering what's going on with Bob and Henry. Jeremy's still in North Carolina. I can't tell you where everyone else is. I don't know if they'd appreciate that, but that's what's happening right now. And of course, Jeremy's been remote for a very long time, over 10 years now, so nothing will change about the network, and I'm finding myself able to be much more productive because I can simply walk to another room and close the door, and I suddenly can podcast. And that was not always the case because I have a noisy parrot, but I can move him far away from me in this nice condo I live in today.
Now you can officially display your Earthbound video game properly here, your old box, as seen on the hit sitcom Frasier.
Yes, that episode of Frasier made it famous. Yeah, it's right behind me. I had this Earthbound box in my closet for about 10 years, but now it's prominently displayed behind me. I should not even have it facing the window. There's basically what I call a thieving ledge outside of my fourth floor condo. It's like, why is there a ledge just big enough for a person to sneak along? I feel like they're inviting Lupin-style criminals into my condo, and I don't appreciate that. Yeah. So we're going to get to listener comments. But I wanted to give some added value to this podcast, so we're not just doing listener comments. So I did want to talk about briefly just the sheer amount of remakes that are coming out towards the end of 2023 and towards the beginning of 2024. And I couldn't even include them all because this could just be a podcast about those. But I did want to go over a few of them just to talk about what they are, if we're excited, and I want to hear your comments about them today. And if you're listening in the future, check in with us. How were some of these? Were we wrong to be excited about them? But I do want to start off with, I won't go in order here, but I do want to start off with the one that I think that we're most excited about, which is coming out very shortly after this podcast. It is the Super Mario RPG remake that's coming out on November 17th. Henry, I know you're excited for this game.
I had no expectation that this game would ever get a remake because, you know, I think many years ago, Mario and Luigi Retronauts, we talked about how, you know, the characters in it are owned by Square, and to even get Geno in the first Mario and Luigi seemed like it was took a lot of work for just a cameo. I figured they wouldn't work together with them to do it. And then when that trailer started on that direct, I was in shock. I was in shock, and I love the design of it. They kept everybody looking stubby and silly, but not in an ugly, rare, pre-rendered way.
It was a real surprise. I feel like until recently, this game was not as appreciated as the other Paper Mario and Mario & Luigi series. And I feel like as younger people had more of a say online, it's been reevaluated and reappraised. But I remember people way in the past saying, like in the aughts, saying, you know, well, that was a nice first attempt, but it's so weird and it's kind of like a baby RPG. But, you know, Paper Mario and Mario and Luigi, they figured it out. But I feel like people are going to reevaluate this game or perhaps play it for the first time. And what's really nice about this game is that this is a year of, frankly, too many good games, and they're all 1,000 hours long. I don't think they added any content to this. Maybe they did, but Mario RPG is like a 15-hour game, so this is a finishable game. Mm-hmm. I am still in Tears of the Kingdom. I have not started Pikmin 4. Baldur's Gate is a faraway dream for me. There are so many huge games this year that I still need to get through, so I feel like this is a nice treat before Christmas, a finishable RPG, which is very rare these days.
And I'm really looking forward to seeing the new, fresh localization. We all, you know, elderly people like us love the classic localizations and how something specifically feels like a 1996 localization where you have to count every character and you got to lose some context and all that. But I have a feeling, and also, I mean, Nintendo has some of the best localizers around, and I'm really looking forward to seeing what they can do with a fresh pass on the script of Super Mario RPG.
Yeah, this was a very good localization for 1996, but I know they have a lot more context and a lot more time and a lot more, like you said, Henry, character space. I'm also excited, remastered soundtrack by Yoko Shimomura,
yes.
An amazing soundtrack. It was so weird to go into a GameStop recently, and there was a trailer for it playing, and I'm now in my 40s, and I thought I'd hear Mario RPG music coming from a speaker that was not in my apartment. So, very strange there. So yeah, Mario RPG, we're excited about that. Here's something I'm excited about. I did not think I would be. This is a Mackie choice for this episode. It is coming out. Actually, it's out as of this record. As of this publishing, it's not out as of this recording. But it's the Star Ocean: The Second Story remake for Switch. Now, the first Star Ocean remake is on Switch currently, and it is just the PSP game on the Switch, which is fine. And I thought they'd be doing the same for this. I thought, oh yeah, I bought that like 15 years ago and I didn't really play it, but it's cool more people can play it. Then I downloaded the demo and then I realized like, oh no, this is a proper remake of the best game in the series in terms of giving it a huge visual overhaul. It is like the Octopath Traveler overhaul. Wow. To the graphics that I really like. So this is my pick. I had a very fun summer playing this game for like 1,000 hours in 1998. and I might irresponsibly buy it and start playing it again because the demo really convinced me. If you want to check out the demo on Steam or on Switch, that lets you play for 3 hours. But this is not simply the PSP game on the Switch, and I wish they would have communicated that to consumers because I don't think they are.
Man, I'll look forward to seeing what people think of that because it's a big square of the classic Square games. It's a bit of a blind spot for me though. I didn't play the that's the Tri-Ace series, another Tri-Ace series, right?
Tri-Ace developer, yeah. And I mean, I honestly, Henry, I wouldn't give any other Star Ocean game the time of day. maybe the first one just as an experiment, but I played all the other ones and two. It's so weird. It's so janky. It has so many weird systems and ideas in it. It's just like fun to experiment with.
The thing again with all these Square remakes, like I've already bought, I think the first two, at least the first Front Mission remake is out, and I still haven't started that yet. So.
The second one just came out, so you better get cracking, buddy. And you know what? Also, another thing I wanted to mention is as of this recording, the Metal Gear Collection Volume 1 is out. And those games are finally available to play for the first time in maybe a decade. And I don't even know. I mean, if you count Xbox backwards compatibility, sure. Yes, that's kind of a cheat. But the original Metal Gear Solid 1, 2, and 3 have not been re-released in a very long time, especially 1. So now people can play those games right now. 2023 is crazy, is what I'm saying. This is going to be a landmark year. Oh, sorry, Henry.
No, there are too many games this year. That's my big point. I'm really feeling it right now. There was a year, this is not a retro game, but there were so many years when I would have had time for Alan Wake 2 and have welcomed the opportunity to play it. I literally, I'm thinking now it's maybe late December if I want to make time for it, maybe.
We're going to ask our listeners, can we just take a few months off? it's to increase our gaming knowledge, and I think it would make for better podcasts. Mm-hmm. So yeah, Star Ocean Second Story R, looking forward to that.
Everyone, Jeremy here. Bob's out of the country right now, so I'm hijacking his episode to make a small confession. I'm terrible at shopping for gifts. I always hate to disappoint people, but when it comes to the holidays, gift giving can be a lot like sitting at a table in Vegas. I'm playing long odds and almost always walk away a loser. So let me tell you, I am relieved to have discovered Uncommon Goods, an online marketplace for goods and gifts created by artists and small independent businesses. Uncommon Goods sells a huge variety of unique and high-quality merchandise ranging from apparel to dishware to food, often handmade here in the U.S. in limited quantities. At the moment, I've got my eye on a homemade boba tea kit and a set of wallets created from actually used NFL uniforms for my Secret Santa recipients. I'm also eyeballing a portable bar kit for myself, since I inevitably get roped into playing bartender at family gatherings and no one ever has decent mixing tools. That'll be a real gift that keeps on giving right there. But really, that's true for everything you buy at Uncommon Goods. For every purchase you make, they donate $1 of the transaction to a nonprofit partner of your choice. To date, they've already given back more than $2.5 million. And they're also giving back to Retronauts listeners right now with a special offer. To get 15% off your next gift, go to uncommongoods.com/retro. That's uncommongoods.com/RETRO for 15% off. Don't miss out on this limited time offer. Uncommon Goods. We're all out of the ordinary. Anyway, that's my holiday pitch. Back to Bob.
Also, I have a feeling Henry is looking forward to this. Persona 3 Reload. I think it's very funny this is happening. Now, I love Persona 3. I played 100 plus hours of it. I finished it back in the day, the FES version. Mm-hmm. But they're going through the Persona 4 cycle, or the Persona cycle in which you put out a main Persona game, then you spin it off as much as possible, and then you make a new one. Mm-hmm. Then you make 5. Then you make 6. Here, I feel like they've made every possible spinoff of 5, and they're like, oh, crap, we can't announce 6 yet. Remake 3, hurry! So, yes, this is a full remake of 3, and there was a huge line to play this at PAX. I wasn't going to get in line to play a remake of a game I put 100 plus hours into 15 years ago, but it looks like a fully fleshed out remake on the level of Persona 5 in terms of fidelity.
Oh, for sure. I did stand in that long line at PAX, and it's where I was got to. The time passed fast because I was too busy reading about how CM Punk got fired while waiting in that same line. But that's a story for another podcast. But the game itself, I am excited for. And you're right, Bob. The Persona Studio, they usually go through this, though it's been shaken up a little bit because the main Persona dudes, they then made the new internal studio and they're making that fantasy series. So like that's technically the new like Persona 6, or if there's going to be a Persona 6, it's going to be made not by the director of Persona 3, 4, and 5.
Okay, because I think Persona 5 is now 8 years old.
Yeah,
I think it was a 26 game in Japan. So we're coming up on a decade. But I guess by that point, Persona 4 came out in like 2008.
It's so freaking old. I mean, I was just thinking about how Persona 3 is nearing 20 years old. Not like that close, but it's not a far away either.
Yeah, it's what, like, that's a 2006 game, right? The original release?
I think so, yeah, in Japan. But all that beside the fact, I think it looks great. It's running on Unreal. It looks awesome. I think a lot of people didn't play it. I think P5 was so huge that it really got people to go backwards to play the old games. Like, I forget how big Persona 5 was comparatively. I still think of Persona 4 is like, ooh, that's when it really crossed over, you know. But like, no, 5 is so much bigger. And yeah, it looks great. And my other complaint, though, is that Sega is shooting themselves in the goddamn foot, and it's their fault. There's too many games coming out at the end of January or the start of February, but Sega, at the very least, has the control over Sega/Axis. It's all the same company. They do not need to release Like a Dragon Yakuza 8 a week before this Persona Ooh. 3 remake.
Yeah, that's too much RPG. And then some people will still be finishing that Yakuza side story with Kiryu that comes out in November, which might be out right now when this podcast goes live.
Yes, but I have to give it to Game Pass as well. Like, I'm a Game Pass lover because it is where Japanese companies go like, yeah, we're not going to sell it on the Xbox anyway. Give us some money and we'll just put it on there. And so I could play the Persona Tactics game, that Yakuza game you just talked about, the Kiryu one, and then Persona 3 Reload. I don't even have to pre-order it. I'm just going to get it day one on Xbox.
But the currency you'll be using to pay for those games is time.
Yes, yeah. Look, I probably won't. Persona 3 is a high on my list, but I really cannot wait for Yakuza 8. I mean, the name in America is Like a Dragon 8. I really should just be calling it that, but yeah.
Hey, they called it Yakuza. It's hard to pull a reverse this late into the series,
yes,
you know? But yeah, I'm excited about it too. I should note that I own Persona 5 Royal on two platforms and I have not touched it yet. And I feel like when I start the game and start tweeting about it, people will probably try to stop me and say, no, please, there's more to live for. This is the next 130 hours of your life, Bob. But I got to play Persona 5 at some point. But again, too many games. I'm going to feel weird about playing a 2017 game in 2023 when there's so much on my plate right now. I do want to move on to another Nintendo game though, and I have questions about this. So recently announced Mario versus Donkey Kong for the Switch. This appears to be a remake of the Game Boy Advance game Mario versus Donkey Kong from 2004, but I'm unaware if there's any other content from the many, many games to follow in that series, which involved what they called before the famous movie, the Minions, right?
Mario Minions, I think, but it's crazy because there are a few game series that I've played all of that I'm still just like meh on, but like the versus Donkey Kong series, because I've said it on Retronauts many times before, Donkey Kong 94 is one of my all-time favorite games. So then when Mario versus Donkey Kong originally came out, they're like, this is a sequel to that. Look, and Mario's doing all these moves from it, but it snuck in the little minions walking around, the wind-up toy dolls, the lemmings-like gameplay, and then they just took over the goddamn series. Like, but if this is just a remake of the original versus Donkey Kong, then the minions will be contained. I have a feeling they're going to have more content, but yeah.
Yeah, I only gave the first Mario versus Donkey Kong a shot, and only then I moderately enjoyed it. I just felt like there's something missing here. The pre-rendered graphics were just a little meh to me. Mm-hmm. But then as I got into the press, I noticed every 18 months there'd be a new Mario versus Donkey Kong game out, and I'm like, what are these? Nobody's talking about them. I assume they're keeping some people in work, but good for them. But I have not heard anyone report back on the many, many Mario versus Donkey Kong games.
I review the third one early in my tenure as a games reviewer, and I liked it better than the second one. It had I remember having a fun boss fight that made me so distracted I missed my stop on a train. So I had a good time. Mm. That's a good measurement of quality.
That's a winning endorsement. Yeah. We're going to move on, though. We have a lot to cover. Okay, so we have Final Fantasy VII Rebirth, which comes out at the end of February 2024. Mm. The last Final Fantasy game remake was a very nice treat during the early stages of COVID. I really associate that game with lockdown, mm-hmm. so I played a very huge amount of it. This game I'm excited for. I'm looking forward to seeing how it veers away from the original content, because we don't need to discuss it here. We had an entire podcast about it. The ending of the first remake really shows that we're going in a very different direction with these, and I'm very curious about that. And I think a lot of people assume that you'll just be able to import your save game and, keep your characters and everything. But I really think, for all intents and purposes, this is just going to be a new release, and it'll start you over from wherever it wants to start you over. And maybe there'll be a bonus if you import a save. But I'm looking forward to it regardless, just seeing what Square can do. And I have not finished it yet, but I actually am very much enjoying Final Fantasy 16, so I think Square is on a roll lately.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to this too. I loved Remake, but I do question the end of Remake, and I won't spoil it if you haven't beat it yet, but the end of Remake gets really Kingdom Hearts, and I fear once Nomura opens the door to the Kingdom Hearts style storytelling, I fear it will only increase as the series goes on. So, but my favorite parts of Remake were just the great writing, the great characters, the music, and I really want to I hope there's just more awesome acting. Aerith, Tifa, Barret, they all felt like brand new characters to me in this version. Compare them to Advent Children, and you're just like, bleh, man, everybody's so boring and crappy. It feels so loose and real in Remake.
Yes, I'm glad this is coming out, because, as we know, the first game had a lot of production problems, but it seems like they figured it out now. So that is, I guess the soft release date is end of February. That could change. A few more on our list here. Back to Nintendo. We have Paper Mario, The Thousand Year Door. We've all been screaming at Nintendo. They're finally saying, yes, we will accept your money by giving you the best game in this series. And yes, all you sticker star sickos, stay out of the comments. This is the best one in the series.
Yes.
And I've stuck with it since that game, and I think Origami King was kind of getting back on track, but they should do another one with traditional RPG mechanics, and that's why this one is going to be a very fun game to replay. I played through this game twice, which is rare for an RPG that came out in the 2000s.
I was so excited when they announced this one, too. It was another one that I was like, wow, especially because you figured they would do the first Paper Mario remake before they would just jump straight to Thousand Year Door. This is another of those things that feels like, okay, a year from now there's a Switch 2, because that's why they're remaking everything just to fill out the calendar. This is my guess. I'm not saying I know anything.
Well, when Paper Mario came onto Nintendo Switch Online, I realized, this is never getting remade. Mm. Same thing with Oracle of Ages and Seasons. When that hit Switch Online, I thought, okay, this is confirmation they're not remaking these games. Otherwise, they would make these original versions harder to get your hands on.
But yeah, Thousand Year Door is my favorite Mario RPG. Though I mean, the vibes, if we're just counting vibes, my favorite might be Bowser's Inside Story or the first Paper Mario. But the actual game to play and that I love the most, it is Thousand Year Door, because it's a real ass RPG. And then also has Solid Snake-style sneaking missions with Princess Peach.
I'm looking forward to it, too. I might hold off because, again, there's so much to play, mm-hmm. and this is like a 50-hour game. So I'm excited that more people will get their hands on it. It's been very unavailable. Never released digitally. It was only released via the GameCube disc. So this is going to be a new game for a lot of people. And, yes, it's almost 20 years old. moving on to something that we know little about that's been announced, which is the Luigi's Mansion Dark Moon remake for Switch. Yeah, I think you're right, Henry. They're getting all these remakes out the door because they're working on things for the launch of the next platform. But this is a game I've owned for a while. I haven't played a lot of, and I was going to play it this Halloween until I realized that there's a remake coming out. And I guess technically there is a remake of sorts. If you play the Luigi's Mansion arcade game, all of the geometry of the levels from the 3DS game is intact. Oh. So you're kind of playing through these levels in first person, and it's a fun game. It's kind of, it's weird to say this about an arcade game, but it is too easy. At a certain point, I was getting bored, and I kind of wanted to die. But I mean, in the game, not in real life.
No, yeah.
Yes. But yeah, this is unexpected. I totally forgot about it. And yeah, more 3DS games on Switch, please.
Well, now that every Wii U game is on the, not everyone, but almost everyone.
Where's Xenoblade Chronicles X, damn it? Sorry, go ahead.
But since almost everyone is on there, now they got to remake 3DS games. And yeah, Dark Moon, I reviewed that one when it first came out. I really liked it, especially the ending is one of my favorite like Mario endings I've ever seen. And I also saw that like another interesting localization thing about it was, you know, 10 years ago or however long it was, they were like, oh, no, we can't have the number in it. You can call it Luigi's Mansion 2 in Japan and Europe, but in America, it's Dark Moon. Numbers aren't good. Now the remake is going to be called, I believe, 2 Everywhere, so it's which will fit because it's Luigi's Mansion 3 is the name of the third game. So,
yeah, and I like the third game. It was a bit long, but now I fully trust this development team, and I'm looking forward to seeing their game played by more people. Our last remakes that I'm going to mention here, Silent Hill 2, still need to see more on it. People are very skeptical. Mm-hmm. I think that game was really a product of its time and of a very particular development team, and it's kind of unfair to ask anyone to remake it. So best of luck to Bloober team with this, but I feel like Konami might be setting them up to fail. I don't know. It's hard to see this coming out as a good game.
I mean, I just can't imagine Konami as a publisher, and I feel this way about another Konami thing on this list. Konami is a publisher right now. They do not seem like the type who pays for the A team, an A dev team, to make a game now. They're not going to, they destroyed their internal teams pretty much. So if they're going to hire a developer to remake something, they're not going to spend real money on it. They're going to get the lowest bidder.
I think the issue is if you use the terminology of like an A team who makes AAA games, those are all owned by giant studios now. Like Microsoft owns these guys, Nintendo owns these guys, Sony owns these guys. So there's no one available, and Konami is not going to build a new development team.
Yeah, that'd take even longer. You're right. I'm forgetting that like there are not even, it feels like there's barely even AA developers anymore who are technically independent.
Yeah, I mean, sorry, I don't remember this. Does somebody own Ubisoft, or are they still independent?
They fought off being bought by EA. I believe Ubisoft is still around. They're a monster unto itself, but even they seem like a smaller monster now that Activision has been bought up by Microsoft.
Yeah, so ultimately, with this game, very skeptical. A surprise announcement, though, was that WayForward is remaking the first Clock Tower. A very short game. It's about like 2 or 3 hours, and it's a lot of fun. Very important for the survival horror genre. I love the Super Nintendo version, so I think this could be a good remake because there's just not a lot of content there, so there's very little for them to screw up. And honestly, I trust them with this because the blueprint is laid out for them. So I think this is a very cool thing that they're doing that was very unexpected.
I liked WayForward's Advance Wars remake, like, not love, let me stress that, but I liked it. I trust him too.
So that was pretty good?
Yeah, it was pretty good. It was pretty good, but not, graphically, I miss the warmth of the 16-bit style graphics from the GBA instead of seeing fully rendered 3D dudes on the screen, you know, but that's just how it is.
Yeah, I guess that's just the way the things go in our horrible future. So we're going to move on to other remakes. We have only a few left, by the way. And again, I left some out. There's too many. So we have Metal Gear Solid Delta Snake Eater in 2024. I am skeptical, but also excited about this because I love Metal Gear Solid 3. I think it's my favorite game in the series. And what's odd about this is that this game is coming out, but Konami is also releasing or has released 3 to play on major platforms. So you can still play the original, which is great. I'm curious as to what they're going to add with this. I assume like new voice acting, you know, a new UI and everything. This is just such a big, important game. And next year it is 20 years old. So I am skeptical but curious, and I really want to see them do this right.
I am curious how they're going to pull it off. I mean, the first trailer was just, it wasn't gameplay. It was the usual, like, you know, it was a great fake-out trailer as far as you're counting trailers. But, I mean, you know, it's obvious to say, but, like, Metal Gear, mostly for good, but even warts and all, Hideo Kojima, like, it was the way it was because he was there to say, no, it has to have this, or it has to do this dumb thing, or I do need more time or more money, and I don't, there's not going to be a force there to make sure of it. I hope that at least Snake Eater especially is full of so many, like, wonderfully weird, like, Easter eggs that seem almost pointless, but and time-consuming to recreate, but if they're not there, then the spirit is gone.
I think the one thing they can improve on is the controls, because I grew up with the Metal Gear controls and, you know, getting inured to them. And then if you go back to Metal Gear Solid 3, which I did for a podcast like 7 or 8 years ago, I forgot, like, oh, to lean out from behind cover, you kind of have to hold down like four buttons at once with right. the with the PS2 controller. They're so specific. Everything is so contextual. You're holding down so many buttons at once. I think they could really improve on that by just, you know, integrating Metal Gear Solid 5 controls into Metal Gear Solid 3. That's the one thing I feel like is holding 3 back from being played by a modern audience, is just very of the time controls.
I wonder if they're going to reuse any of those Snake Eater Pachinko assets that are out there.
Ooh. Yes, yes. Hey, they're just lying on the table. I say use them. All those new cutscenes for the Pachinko game. Mm-hmm. And some last ones, we have the Gex Trilogy, which is giving Dana Gould some new work. Mm-hmm. So that's Limited Run Games is releasing that. Those are, I believe, the original side-scrolling 2D game and then the two 3D platformers. So those are being remastered. I'm not sure what more Dana Gould is doing, but he recorded a new trailer for the games. I think he just said it's Tale Time, baby, or something like that.
I mean, hey, they got him involved. That's good. That's good enough for me. And then, I mean, I forget who, I would guess the Embracer Group owns Gex now, right? Because he would have been part of the Eidos thing that got sold off by Square.
Yes, they have been embraced, and I guess that's why Gex is being made through Limited Run Games.
Yeah, right.
I guess they're now a publisher of, I take it, new games now, which is interesting, because I think this the last remake on my list is Tomba, the Metroidvania game for the PS1. That's coming out through Limited Run Games. They're also doing like digital releases, which is new for them, which I applaud, because I don't like buying games in boxes. I think it complicates things. I just want to download the game and play it. But the one new thing I can see of this, it's just been announced recently, and it feels like the soundtrack is being remastered, but I'm not sure what other elements of the game will be changed, if any. Tomba is fun. It can be a little rough at times, but I think people should play it. And this was released back when I was doing Retronauts originally, like in 2012. By Monkey Paw Games. They were releasing some like harder to find
right.
PS1 and PS2 games. Some of them weren't even translated, honestly. They just were like, here's a bunch of weird Japanese games you can download mm-hmm. with your American account. But now it's getting a bigger release. More people should know about Tomba. I think they should do the second game as well, because I think that's very underappreciated, and it's like $600 now, I'm sure, or more to get in the case.
I remember Monkey Paw was making it so a lot of working designs games got a second chance. But
yes, and because of Monkey Paw, I have a very rare Tomba plush doll that they gave us a very long time ago. So if I ever need to make a mortgage payment, I'll put that on Twitter or something. I'll let you know. But yeah, any other final thoughts on all these remakes, Henry? There's a lot coming out.
There are so many, and it's not fair because there's already too many video games as is. And then you know what? My final thought too is like it's the completely MIA Dragon Quest III remake that technically, you know, got announced, I think, 2 years ago now, and TGS passed with nothing about it.
Yeah, yeah. It was going to be one of those 2D HD ones like Octopath.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, and DQ3 is one of my all-time faves in the series. Like, if my rankings would go 11, 5, And then three, honestly. I think I'd put three, maybe nine above three, because nine is just three, but better or newer. So
yeah, I mean, I love three, and I have to wonder, I don't know who's developing three. If it is the Dragon Quest developers, maybe it's all hands on deck for 12.
Yeah.
Because we've seen nothing of 12. We saw a logo many years ago, and I guess Yuji Horii's saying it's going to be more mature or something, and that's basically it, right?
Yuji Horii says a lot of things, though. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Well, who knows? I'm looking forward to 12 whenever it comes. I honestly don't think we'll be playing it for like another 3 years, but Godspeed. I hope there's not a year between the release in Japan and the localization in America like there was last time. We weren't even doing that then. We shouldn't be doing it anymore.
I'm really hopeful they've actually closed the gap. Square has closed the gap and done virtually everything Universal launches, and that includes recent Dragon Quest games, have been global launches. So I'm hopeful they'll do the same for this. The only reason I could see it not happening is just that somebody like Yuji Horii as a writer is just like, no, I want to finish this. If my script is done, I want to release it in Japan soon. I don't want to wait 6 months for us to finalize the scripts for every other language. I want, like, let's put out the game sooner in Japan.
Yeah, he might still have complete control over that. Yeah. But yeah, in any case, I'm looking forward to the next Dragon Quest. But now let's move on to listener comments and questions.
Hi folks, it's Jeremy again. Listen, we're smack in the middle of my least favorite month of the year. That's right, it's Novembeard. There are so many better ways to raise money for charity than by afflicting yourself with an itchy soup catcher, you know? At least Harry's has our backs. They make high-quality shaving gear to keep your face looking clean and aerodynamic at incredible prices. A premium shave without the premium price tag. Thanks to Harry's, you can look freshly shorn and still afford to donate to charity. I've been using their shaving gear myself, and their standard razor and blade kit and shaving gel has given me the cleanest shave I've had in years. And their German-engineered 5-blade razor cartridges last a surprisingly long time without going dull. Their kit comes with a convenient travel cover, too, which means I can finally take a decent razor on the road with me without worrying about it breaking in transit due to rough baggage handling. Now even the TSA can't stand between me and a good shave. Harry's is a great deal, with refills starting at just $2 per delivery, and right now it's an even better deal for Retronauts listeners. They're offering the $13 starter set for just $3 at harrys.com/retro, which includes their trademark 5-blade razor, a durable weighted handle, foaming shave gel, and the travel cover. Be sure to also check out their great variety of facial care products in addition to the standard kit. Creams, washes, and lotions that'll keep your face hydrated and soft throughout the bitter, cold winter months. Honestly, there's no reason not to try Harry's. It's a great deal, and it's guaranteed entirely risk-free. If you don't like your standard kit shave, it's on them. So get your best shave ever with Harry's razors and skincare products. Get a $13 starter set for just $3 at harrys.com/retro. That's harrys.com/retro for a $3 starter set.
Yes, let's talk about some listener comments and questions. So our first comment is from episode 357. It was called 10 Years of the Nintendo 3DS, and this was released nearly 3 years ago on February 8th, 2021. Henry was not on this, but I know he has some thoughts, so I'll read this one. Nigel G says, three cheers for Street Passes, the 3DS's killer feature. I carried mine everywhere I went from 2011 to mid-2017, including 2 years I lived overseas. I went to PAX during the craze, and it was nearly as satisfying as tagging people in Dragon Quest IX when that game came out. It's been years since I've been to an event like that, but if I go to one again, I'll probably have my trusty 3DS in tow.
I'm sad I missed out on this one, but hey, I can't be on every podcast. But yeah, I love the 3DS in general. Like, it was my first launch as a professional games reviewer and games journalist, and so I got to be part of it from the beginning. Like, the first E3 I attended was the 3DS launch E3, and yeah, the Street Pass in particular, though, I love it's some of my favorite memories, and I'm so sad they just left it behind on the Switch. I not just getting the puzzles, I loved covering cons like PAX and also Comic-Con, San Diego Comic-Con. I would bring my Street Pass with me, and sometimes they'd even launch brand new puzzles right before Comic-Con would start, and I would take my Nintendo appointment, dutifully write my preview and send it to my editor, and I'd be like, okay, I'm now going to sit here for another hour and get my 10 Street Passes, clear it out, 10, clear it out, 10, clear it out, over and over and over again.
Yeah, I know I mentioned my story. It's similar to yours, Henry, on that podcast back 3 years ago, but I was in the press as well around this time. I joined right after the 3DS came out. I attended so many conventions with the 3DS, got so many Street Passes. But a word to the wise, if you still go to a convention, like Nigel G says, make sure you bring your 3DS, because you will still get a lot of Street Passes, especially if you go to the Portland Retro Gaming Expo or any Retro Gaming Expo. I always bring mine. I'm always checking my Street Passes, and it's a fun trip to the carefree days of 2013. When you were looking at people's hats, you were sending them messages, you were playing one of many optional games. I wasn't doing that, by the way, because I spent too much of my life on that already. But people are still out there. People are still Street Passing. I'm about to bring my 3DS to Japan to a big event, and I want to get a lot of Street Passes in Japan because I've never done that before, and I'm sure it will be happening at the event I'm going to.
Oh, man, yeah. When I went to Japan, the year the 3DS LL came out in Japan before the XL, I bought my LL there, and then I was like, oh, then I can double Street Pass, and I can Street Pass myself, and also the Mii Plaza games are so much goddamn fun. Like, and this is one other like Star Snoop thing I did, but what a Nintendo fanboy I was, when I would get at E3 and got to do Nintendo press interviews, I always had my Street Pass on, and I was constantly, if I had a second, I'd be like, okay, open Street Pass. Okay, clear out. Let's get, because I really wanted to get like Reggie or Miyamoto's Street Pass. I never got their real Street Pass, but I did get Takashi Tezuka, the big wig of Mario series.
Yeah, at Portland this year, there was some guy from Nintendo there. I don't know. I forget who it was. I don't have my 3DS on me right now, but it was a special Mii from Nintendo. So maybe a Nintendo guy was at the event or something. I don't know. But so, yeah, you can still Street Pass. Mm. Even though, you know, Nintendo shut down the store and everything, Street Passing still works. I recommend you try it if you go to a big convention about video games. So up next, we have episode 360, which was gaming in the year 2001. This one came out in February of 2021. Henry, can you take this one?
Dale says, loved a lot of the reminiscing here, but there was one thing said that kind of gnawed at me. It feels like the PS2 launch lineup gets a bad rap like it did here for being utter trash. While there may not have been a killer app, there are plenty of genre-specific hits in there, like DOA2's Tekken Tag and SFEX3 for fighters, Time Splitters and Unreal Tournament for FPS, Ridge Racer 5, and the original Midnight Club for racing. And while I know sport games aren't popular here, it should be noted, the EA debuted their brand new NFL engine with Madden 2001 to acclaim, which catapulted future Madden releases to being event releases. SSX was a surprise hit debut of the PS2 launch, so while there may have not been any 9.5 to 10 rated games in the launch, there was plenty of quality titles to choose from.
And yes, Dale, I hope you have not been stewing for the past 3 years, but I do agree with you. It was a big launch in terms of like a sheer variety of game experiences, because I think the PS2 American launch was maybe 8 months after the Japanese launch or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, for me, though, it was, okay, I'll get SSX and play that until Zone of the Enders comes out, and I'm buying that for the Metal Gear Solid 2 demo, and then maybe like Klonoa 2 in the summer. But yeah, I do agree with you, Dale. It had a huge variety of games at launch, but the fall of 2001 was so big for the PS2 that everything is in its shadow that came before, because fall of 2001 is like Silent Hill 2, Metal Gear Solid 2, Grand Theft Auto 3, Final Fantasy 10. It was just everything was coming for the PS2 that fall.
Mm-hmm. To battle the GameCube and Xbox. They saved it all for that. I think a lot of my negativity, I've had it out there too, of negativity toward the PS2 launch is because I didn't think I'd get one at launch, and I didn't. My brother, when I still lived at home with my brother when it came out, we both were like, no, we're going to get a GameCube and Xbox because we've got the Dreamcast this year, and the Dreamcast is forever, and it's going to be so great.
It won't die in 18 months.
So that's why I think I looked down on the PS2 launch, because I was thinking, why are people excited for any of this trash? They don't know about Phantasy Star Online. Come on.
You know, I feel like there was maybe a 10-year time period in which launches were bad, but now they've been pretty good again, because with the Switch, we had, you know, Breath of the Wild. Oh, yeah. And with PS5, we had the Demon's Souls remake. And also with PS5 and Xbox Series, what is it? Come on, help me out here. Is it Series S?
Oh, the Series X. S is Series the cheap X. One. X is the good one.
Well, let's say with the new Xbox generation, yes, you have the new games for it, but also you're going to be playing all the old games that are still coming out for the last generation of hardware. Mm-hmm. So now that there's not a big cutoff between hardware generations, I feel like launches aren't bad anymore.
Oh, yeah, no. It all just like seamlessly moves into the next one, unless I could still think that on the Switch 2, Nintendo goes like, nah, we're still not doing backwards compatibility again.
If they do that, you know what's going to happen? I'm still going to give them money because I'm a big sucker.
Oh.
I guess they've got me by, I'm not going to say anything dirty here. Let's say the neck, because I can't play Mario or Zelda games anywhere else, but I hope they learn their lesson. I have so many digital games on Switch, but Switch is the only thing I buy digital games for, because I do it all for Steam, and I know Steam will never go away. It can't. It's impossible.
My last thought on the PS2 launch or launch-ish window was that it did make the Dynasty Warriors games like a thing in America, because I'd never seen a game like that before at that level of fidelity. And, you know, I still, every couple of years I will play a Musou game for like 10 hours and love 9 hours of it. And on that 10th hour, I go like, I think I've done enough of this and stop.
You know, I made a lot of headway into that, into the Breath of the Wild themed Musou game.
Mm-hmm.
But I made like 40 hours in, and I want to go back to it. But frankly, I was unlocking too many characters, and I thought, like, this is just too much content. This could be someone's game for the entire year, which, you know, in a way is a great value. But I kind of wanted to steamroll to the end, and it wasn't letting me. But that one was surprisingly good. I did like Dragon Quest Heroes. That's the one I actually finished.
Oh, yeah.
Heroes, but I never touched Heroes 2.
Yeah, how was their One Piece one? Was that any good?
They're okay. I think if there is a company breathing down their neck, like Square Enix with the Dragon Quest one or Nintendo with the Zelda ones, they do a much better job because they're held to a higher standard. But with licensed ones, they can fall back on, you know, being a lesser game.
I remember I got to interview the director of that game before the first Zelda Musou game. And I'm paraphrasing, but they basically joked that Nintendo made them be less horny. I was like, they said they had views on the outfits for some of the women we designed.
Put some clothes on Linkle. We all forgot about Linkle, didn't we?
Oh, right, yeah.
The female Link, yes. We're going to move on, though, to 393, The Perils of Peach, released in July of 2021. And Purple Comet says, I believe the Mushroom Kingdom does have a hive-like societal structure, with Peach having different physical characteristics because she is a queen, though the title princess is used. The royal mushroom power-up obtainable by Toadette is similar to the royal jelly used to turn a queen bee candidate into an actual queen. By becoming Peachette, Toadette could theoretically challenge Peach for control of the hive if it came down to it, but using the mushroom as a temporary power-up isn't sufficient to induce permanent change. And as for Rosalina, I think it is very possible that this is a genus of toad person above even princess, with Luma being her equivalent of toads, propagating toad-like creatures throughout the universe, notwithstanding her backstory being a possible reverse time-traveling daughter of the Princess Peach we know, who lives through the end of the universe to witness the birth of a new one, and herself now continues this cycle. That was a mouthful. And Purple Comet, I appreciate your theorizing, but we all know the Mario movie has put forth the idea that Peach was a baby who was teleported into the Mushroom Kingdom, and the weird little mushroom people decided to worship her as a god.
Mm-hmm. They're like, oh, you're a baby, you should be our queen. We'll build a castle for you, and just for you, and you're our boss. And I mean, Well, because Peach is great at doing everything in that world, then she should be the queen. Though this makes me just want to see Bowsette be the queen. But obviously, when I walked around PAX, by the way, and saw so many Bowsette cosplayers that it tricked me into thinking, like, right, Bowsette, the real character, when's she going to be playable? It was a horny meme. That's not a real character.
Frankly, I'm a Princess Boo guy, but, you know, we're a rare breed. But I think that ever since Miyamoto really clamped down on these games telling any kind of story, mm-hmm. it just makes us speculate more and more. Like, who are these people? What is the kingdom like? Who is Rosalina? What's her deal? I feel like, the Mario games are better without story, mm-hmm. but I kind of want to see more explanations of things. We recently did a Bowser podcast, there's a Bowser podcast coming up that I recorded. And we're all asking the question, like, who is Bowser Jr.'s mother? Mm-hmm. If you don't give us the answer, all of the answers in our head are just filthy, and we can't do this anymore. It's been 20 years.
I'm just happy. And look, I'm a Rosalina lover. I love Rosalina, but I'm happy that Ian Wonder, the second princess you get to play with in it, is Daisy. Daisy finally gets to be on the level of Peach in one of the main Mario games.
It's about damn time. So we're going to move on to episode 400. To ring in this pivotal episode, we covered Garfield games.
Right.
And this happened in August of 2021. Henry, can you take this one?
Yes. Paul says, I remember I had some kind of print shop program. It was either on Apple 2GS or Windows 3.1. And I don't recall if the whole program was Garfield branded or if it would just had Garfield content, but there was a ton of clip art you could use to make your own Garfield strips, almost like a primitive Garfield-themed Mario Paint. I used to spend hours on it making completely incomprehensible Garfield strips and forcing my parents to pretend that they were funny. I've never been able to find any info on the program. Update! Looks like this was Scholastic Comic Book Maker featuring Garfield from 1998. So I was vastly off on when I played this. Yeah, I would have been 15. It must have been my nephew who was the one showing off his nonsensical comics.
Yeah, I had grown out of edutainment by the time these came out, but I do remember like the Spider-Man cartoon maker and the Simpsons cartoon maker. I mean, you weren't making cards or stationery, but you were playing around with assets and, you know, sound effects and things like that. They seem very fun, and I wish I would have had that as a kid, but was I think the biggest thing I had was like the Tiny Toons like cartoon creator for the NES, which was not good.
Yeah.
It's just like they were trying, but they really couldn't do what the concept wanted to execute on.
I was mystified by the ads that said, like, hook it up to your VCR and record the game. And I was like, wait, how do you, I can hook up an NES to a VCR and, like, record gameplay? What are you talking about?
Yeah, foreign concept to me. I think it wasn't until Mario Kart where I bought the strategy guide and it showed you, like, here's how you can do this at home. And I was like, oh, you just, like, run wires through other wires on their way to the TV. That makes sense. Okay.
Though in 1998, I was not playing Scholastic Comic Book Maker, but I was downloading, or maybe it was 99 or 2000, I was downloading from, like, the King Features website Garfield screensavers to put on our computer back then.
Did they make any noise? Did he talk?
The one I remember is he would close and open the fridge, and he wouldn't make noise, but there would be like sound effects in it.
So we're going to move on to episode 402, Kid Icarus, released in September of 2021. And Louis says, like listening to this, but they end up giving too short shrift to how Gonzo Uprising gets. There's the alien invasion, the interdimensional phenomenons, the near genocidal reset bomb, the pirate ship in the sea in space, humans and gods waging war, everything involving the time jump. The new characters are also a lot of fun, especially Viridi, and Magnus.
Yeah.
And I like their redesign for the older ones like Pit, Thanatos, Pandora, and Palutena, with the latter in particular looking like the character designer was left, was Terry to out ornament. Sorry, what is this?
I think was trying to out ornament or make more accessories in Tetsuya Nomura, I think is what they're saying.
Yes, yeah. Lots of little danglies hanging from her. And you know what, Luis? I want to give this game more of a try, but it puts me in a great deal of pain. And I really respect it on so many levels. It's such a cool idea for a game. And we're talking about how all these remakes are coming out for the Switch and its final year or 18 months or whatever is happening with the Switch. I feel like we are not far away from this being announced. Maybe it's already happened when this goes live. Who knows? Mm-hmm. But I feel like there's nothing about this game that needs the 3DS to function. All the screen is just the analog stick that the system did not come with. So I feel like it would be so perfect. And I'm watching Masahiro Sakurai's videos on YouTube and being reminded, like, this guy knows so much about game design, so much about game history. And it sucks that this game is stuck on one platform in a really non-ideal control scheme.
I wonder if it's that without Iwata around to convince him to do it, Sakurai won't let it get ported to anything. I wonder if that's it.
I hope it's not like a secret shame that just never goes anywhere, like a Virtual Boy game or something like that. It's so cool. I have so much respect for it, but it hurts me.
But yeah,
if this came out when I was a kid, I would have enjoyed it a lot more. But my old wrists, they've been through so much.
The plot is insane, though. Louise is correct that the turns, everybody talks about how, you know, say in the first Last of Us game, everybody's like, whoa, who expected this turn? This is longer or gets weirder than I thought, you know, in the middle of the game. But this is way bigger than that, way bigger. I feel like that, or at least on that same level, I feel like PlayStation games, especially the Last of Us games, it's almost baked in now where I'm just like, well, I know at 50% in this game, a crazy thing will happen that'll change this plot, but Icarus Uprising was doing that way, way before.
Yes. Once again, play it, but don't sue us if you hurt yourself. So we're going to move on to 405, Grand Theft Auto 3. You were not on this, Henry, but you were alive during the phenomenon, so I did include this. So it's a September of 2021 episode, and Cajun Baz says, Henry, can you take this
yes.
one?
Yes. The making of the Rockstar DMA and even Take-Two Interactive is more interesting than the games they've made. David Kushner, the author of Masters of Doom, also wrote Jacked, the story of GTA. Ryan Brandt, the founder of Take-Two, is the son of a billionaire. Supermodel Stephanie Seymour is his stepmom. The Hauser's mom is Geraldine Moffat, a British actress who played Glenda in Get Carter in 1971. The Hauser's went to St. Paul's, an elite secondary school. With a lot of money and connections, they created these publishing houses because they wanted to be cool and stylish. They weren't developers, but at this time, we are entering an era in gaming where being Jobs is more important than being Wozniak. GTA 3, as produced by these overprivileged kids, was the product that perfectly married their affinity for showbiz, see who their parents are, and their eagerness to be on the street fringe, even though they live in penthouses.
We're learning so much. I'm going to say more like Grand Theft Nepo.
I know. I didn't realize these guys were so posh. They're posh pretending to be common people, as the Pulp song goes.
Yes, they're watching these crime movies in their penthouses with private security surrounding it.
I mean, yes, their lack of development background and all that, it makes sense then. There are all those stories of the Housers just going, no, more late nights, more late nights. Nope. Got to make sure every shingle on this house in Red Dead
Resident
Revolver
Evil.
3 or whatever.
Yeah.
Yes, it has to be correct. Yeah, it's insane. Yes.
And they make a game like every 5 or 6 years. Mm-hmm. They could take their time. And it should be, I mean, Grand Theft Auto 5 just turned 10. I've still not played it. Yes, I do own it on a platform. But it's one of the like three top selling games of all time just because of Grand Theft Auto Online. And just because it's also now been made available for like three hardware generations.
Yeah.
Because it was a PS3 360 game, then ported to Xbox One and PS4, ported again to PS5 and the new Xbox generation. Ported to PC. I'm surprised there was not some like Switch cloud version of it yet. That'd be interesting to see. But yeah, it's the game that can't stop selling.
Yeah, it's they've made more money not making GTA 6 than they would have if they made GTA 6. It's
and I'm sure the political commentary has not been dated by a day.
Oh, not at all.
what they probably wrote in like 2011. So we're going to move on to episode 418. This was Batman, the animated series games. This kicked off, actually, it was a cross-promotion because Henry and I had just started our Blab and Bat Batman series on the Talking Simpsons Network, and we have a ton of episodes over there if you want to hear us talk about some great episodes of that series. But Charles says, glad to hear you guys giving love to Batman Adventures in this episode. And by the way, this is Bob speaking. That is the comic book that was running concurrently with the cartoon and using the designs and some of the writers, some of the artists. Charles continues to say, it really is a legit Batman book and not just some cheap tie-in dreck. If you are looking for more in that vein, Paul Dini and Alan Burnett have been doing a book that picks up the story where WB's run left off. Though its place in the canon is in limbo due to inconsistencies with the characters, with a certain character's post-BTAS story, still worth checking out. They even have Ty Templeton on art for the first 8 issues. And I looked into this, and my note was that this actually wrapped up, I believe, this year. So there were 3 seasons of this comic book called Batman, The Adventures Continue. And I'm really interested in this because I think last holiday season on Comixology, they had all of the trades for Batman Adventures on sale for like $3 each. So I have all of them now. And I'm waiting for the time to dig into all of them because they're all basically new to me, except for the few that we read for the podcast.
I have read a little of The Adventure Continues because the first volume is on Kindle Unlimited, which I subscribe to. And it is really good to see, especially Ty Templeton was the master of the Batman Adventures comics back then. They, I remember being very good. I was reading it a little wistfully because obviously in the it's now been a year since he passed away. But yeah, after Kevin Conroy passed away, I wanted to give it a little more of a read. And now, sadly, Arlene Sorkin also no longer with us either. So, yep.
Yeah, very, very sad. I mean, it's all happening like within the past year or so. And as we're doing the podcast, I think Kevin Conroy passed away when we started our second season of that podcast, kind of like the day before it launched, which was bad timing on his part. Come on, Kevin.
Yeah, come on. Hold it together. No, no. But yeah,
yes, we love the man. He recorded me a very nice cameo once. I have nothing against him.
No, he was the greatest. But yeah, that the Dini and Burnett, them writing more of it's great, especially because I feel like Dini doesn't get to write enough of the old of the new Batman content that he could be writing. It feels like he's not invited to the parties as much as Bruce Timm is.
That's unfortunate. So we're going to move on to episode 432, Escape from New York, a fun episode we recorded with Chris Cabin from We Hate Movies, I believe. And Rio Gio says, I guess this is your comment, Henry.
Oh,
go
yes.
for it.
I can say without reservation that when this movie was released, at least within the microcosm of my life at the time, it was the coolest thing ever. I was 13 at the time, so this is right in the convergent zone of both nostalgia and, no, you don't understand, this is one of the greatest movies of all time. To my peer group, this movie was amazing, cool, and it really was a big deal that Kurt Russell was making this transition from Disney star to gritty action man. Having been a talking Simpsons subscriber since the dawning, I can say to both Henry and Bob, I always appreciate your pity, sincerely, when you speak of the state of entertainment during my formative years. Thundar, Dungeons & Dragons, the animated series, and reruns of Herculoids were all we had, and when something as slick as Escape from New York was released, we ate it up. I saw it 3 times in the theaters and loved every minute of it. The gun was exotic. Snake was always in control, even when he wasn't. And Adrienne Barbeau, well, you covered that in the podcast. We all appreciated her character quite a bit.
Yes, thank you so much, Rio Gio. And apologies for being a Gen Xer. We know you had it rough.
Yes. Yeah.
Actually, I was thinking of this when we recently did a panel in Portland for the Portland Retro Gaming Expo, and it was covering all the appearances of Mario over time in media. And I felt great regret with having to play a clip from the Donkey Kong animated series from the early 80s. I thought, like, I feel so bad for anyone who had to watch Saturday Supercade. It just seems like a bummer, a real bummer. And, you know, the first part of our lives, Henry, we had some bad cartoons, but then things really picked up in the 90s and we had lived through a golden age. And cartoons are great now, don't get me wrong, but it took them a very long time to get on the level to make them watchable by most people.
To even be, like, even a little cool. I mean, it made the Super Mario Brothers Super Show look good by comparison, watching that Donkey Kong one.
Yes, good and competent.
But, no, Escape from New York was, I couldn't imagine how cool it would have been to have seen it when it was new. Like, it was just so cool to see, to catch up with in my youth in the 90s. And also, isn't it nuts to think that, like, the sequel to it, 10 years feels like nothing to me now, but the difference in time between the sequel of Escape from LA to New York feels impossibly long, and everything feels different by the time they get that movie out.
Yes, I'm actually thinking of that, just how these gaps in years used to feel long, because I recently rewatched Return of the Living Dead, a 1985 movie that's riffing on Night of the Living Dead, which started the genre as we know it. And at that point in time, Night of the Living Dead was a 17-year-old movie. But they're talking about it like it's a classic. Like, you remember that movie, Night of the Living Dead? Wasn't that awesome? Well, that'd be like us talking about a movie from 2006 today.
Remember the original Transformers, Bob, in 2007? That was so important.
I choose not to. So, yes, please watch Escape from New York. If you take anything from that podcast, just please watch that movie. It's very, very good. Moving on, we have the awkwardly named GameCube to Game Boy Advance Link Cable Games because Nintendo didn't give that peripheral a better name. Hey, it's on them.
It's as awkward as the marketing of it.
Yes, they buried it quickly. We're going to talk about what Aaron says next, and Aaron says, there are times I consider getting a Switch Mini solely as a Pac-Man versus device, but that's a lot to ask. I think the most obvious and possibly most important use case for the device is interacting with Pokemon Colosseum and XD, as those two games make it possible for someone to complete the Gen 3 Pokedex, excluding mythical encounters, on their own without needing to trade with lots of other people. Sure, Pokemon Box is a Pokemon Box, but the other two games actually use the GBA interface in interesting ways, since they let you migrate your party into the story mode for use in getting a Ho-Oh from Mount Battle and Colosseum, or the competitive mode, much more in line with what you could do in Stadium and serving similar purposes. Half-baked in practice, perhaps, but at least you could transfer Chao from Sonic Adventure 2 Battle to Sonic Adventure DX and vice versa, meaning the amount of grinding you do to get the Chao Race emblems wasn't totally egregious. While the tiny Chao Gardens have notable advantages, specifically the ability to get higher stat boosts out of every level up than the GameCube Gardens, and no passage of time for Chao aging, I have to favor the pace of the original Sonic Adventure 1 Chao Garden and the story mode of Sonic Adventure 2's Chao Adventure 2 game. And thank you. That was a lot about this little Unla peripheral. And honestly, I think we said it on the podcast. It was just the unpopularity of the GameCube that made this go away as soon as possible. It's like the GameCube, nobody likes it. I mean, we liked it, of course, yeah. But it was not a popular mass market product. And this just made it look worse. So it was like quietly swept under the rug by Reggie Fils-Aimé.
It's very funny that their big approach was like, okay, you didn't like Pac-Man versus, but what if we made things easier for you Pokemon freaks? Will you please, all of you millions of children buying Game Boy Advance Pokemon games, will you please buy a GameCube and do some Pokemon stuff on that too? Pretty please.
And maybe it kind of worked, but it was a big failure.
And also, my brother was super addicted to the Chao Gardens. I could not understand it. He played it all the time.
I feel like it's the younger millennials. The older millennials simply didn't get it. I know I did. I'm like, what am I supposed to do? Like, and then I read all of these tweets that would happen much later. Like, oh, look at all these cool things and different costumes and all this weird. It was such a deep system in the game that I barely interacted with. So we're moving on to X-Men Games, episode 438, that came out in February of 2022. And Henry, what does Jonathan say?
Great episode. I will never forget seeing the four-player version of X-Men Arcade for the first time at a local pizza place and being amazed at it. The fluidity of the animation, voice samples, and the special moves made it a favorite of my friends and I. Also wanted to say that despite the claim, people do remember the Phalanx Covenant. I got a package collection of Generation Next comics before the trade paperbacks, I guess, and loved them. They were my first real venture into X-Men comics rather than the animated series or games. Marvel really tried to sell people on that series, and it seems like they put a lot of money into it with that weird live-action special they made, and those characters never really seemed to take off. And yeah, that's Generation X is what they're not. Generation Next, I think, was the event, but Generation X with the comics. And it did get a pilot for like, what if we did a teen show for X-Men but new mutant characters?
Yeah, I have very vague memories of that in the pages of Wizard, but I have no like concrete memories of Generation X, right?
Yeah, Generation X. Yeah, yeah.
Okay, because I know like, well, I read Gen 13, and I know they made an animated pilot based on that, but I have no Gen X memories.
Generation X didn't have half of the sexuality of Gen 13. That's why people don't remember it the same. But as for X-Men Arcade, that reminded me of one of my favorite moments at Portland Winter Game Expo I had. Was just walking over through the free play arcade machines, and three people were playing on the six-player X-Men, and then I stepped up, and then two more people came on, and we were doing a full six-player X-Men, and I was Dazzler, who I rarely play as.
That's great. You just need the smell of pizza around you to complete that the effects of playing that game in 1992.
I was smelling other things at PGRE, unfortunately.
Yes. Hey, it's a convention. I actually had a cool moment with that game. I saw it, too. And I was able to show my wife, Nina, like, hey, look, if you look in the cabinet, you can see the other TV is actually pointing up at a mirror. And because she's very short, I had to, like, say, like, get on your tiptoes and check that out. So I don't think she knew that it was the TVs were not side by side. There's one TV face up shooting at a mirror, because I'm sure two of them next to each other, there'd be a lot of interference. It'd get very hot in that machine.
It's an amazing monster of a machine that you can't really fake with a big wide monitor you stick in there. It's got to be two TVs, and the perfect arcade experience would be if one TV's uglier than the other and the colors are off when you jump between the two sides of the screen.
Yes, one has to be like, one of the colors has to be dead on the other TV. It's only like green and blues that are available.
Wolverine's I saw green, like, over here in this version.
There is like a very nasty Street Fighter II machine in this bar in Vancouver called the Narrow Lounge. And I think, like, the green and blue channels are missing, so it's just, like, the entire screen, everything is, like, blood red. It's the Halloween edition of Street Fighter 2. So check that out at the Narrow Lounge in Vancouver. They have very cheap burritos, and they're very good. Moving on to Episode 462, Kirby Part 3, released in June of 2022. And this patron says, I remember watching Right Back At Ya at the tail end of my interest in the Fox Box programming block. I was born in 1992. Just like Kirby, and mostly started watching Foxbox for Yu-Gi-Oh!, which ran a few years before Kirby, and a bunch of other programs filtered in and out of the block during that time. I didn't really like the Kirby show at the time, and in retrospect, only watch it to fill the time. But I do think it, and the other four kids programs at that time, were an interesting artifact of the tail end of a particular period of anime localization aimed at kids, where they tried to hide that it was from Japan. Mm-hmm. Toonami had been on the air for a while by then, and I had been hooked on that a few years earlier with Dragon Ball Z, and I feel like there was much less a focus of sanding down the Japanese edges for American viewers. Whereas 4Kids and its peers seem very interested in getting the content slanted towards American taste, I think the most obvious example is Pokemon with the rice balls versus jelly donuts, but I remember ad bumpers on Foxbox all the time of various characters and Yu-Gi-Oh! Having a ton of changes. Am I right to think there's not as much of a focus now on hiding that anime, even for kids, is from Japan? And you are right to think there is not that effort anymore. I think they underestimated how much kids knew about the media they were watching, because even at a very early age, before the internet, I knew, like, there's this place called Japan. Video games that look like this come from Japan. Cartoons that look like that come from Japan, and it's the coolest place in the world. And you can sort of tell, as kids are savvier than you think, and I think they can tell when things are being, you know, censored for them or changed for them to make them think different things. So, yeah, it was a very different time. And we're not doing this anymore. And I honestly feel like my joke answer is like the last World War II grandpa had to die. And that now it's finally safe to put Japanese contents in the American home. Before that, your grandpa would be smoking his pipe in a chair like, what is this? He would just see the rising sun flag. He'd have a heart attack. We don't know what's going to happen. But now they're all dead. And we can finally get Japanese content on TV.
I think the last gasp of it being around then also coincided with expansions in digital replacement tech that it looks very bad if you watch it now, but they could back then, you know, take scenes like, say, the Squirtle Squad doing spray paint in Japanese, and they could put English text on it. Of course, the jelly donuts or a sandwich or whatever, all of those things. But I think they aren't afraid of that anymore. I think they finally, by they I mean the companies who sell things, they understand that you don't want to hide it's Japanese, because you actually make more money if people know it's Japanese.
And because of globalization and just how quickly things have advanced, thanks to the internet, you know what sushi is, you know what an onigiri is. Even in smaller towns, you can have access to these things, or at least via the internet, you can order, you know, Japanese snacks and know what they are. So I think they really can't fool anyone. And it honestly feels like it took too much time and effort to disguise those things and pretend like this Japanese man who lives in a very Japanese house and looks Japanese, his name is like James Smith.
Right. Yeah. They can count on kids. I think it really was Yu-Gi-Oh! And Pikachu teaching people that, like, oh, kids aren't turned off by a weird name, that a weird Japanese name. It doesn't make kids want to buy things any less.
Yeah, it might have been the adults working on this stuff that were projecting their feelings onto children. I'm sure they thought, well, these characters look weird and they're eating things that, like, I would never eat. So why would a kid be into this? But kids love things that are new. They love, like, ooh, what's this? I've never seen this before. And they're attracted to that. And then they learn about Japan. And that's how we grew up.
I think if I also think if Pokemon had not been a smaller production when it started, like when it was sold in America, if it had been picked by like Mattel as this is our next big thing, there would have been much more of the scrubbing away of that stuff. But it, like, the anime was syndicated and sold by Viz, like the American anime company. They are going to sand off fewer edges than a big company.
So we're going to move on to our final set of comments. It's what I call the Super Mario Brothers movie punishment zone, because we all saw this movie back in April. We all didn't like it. I really want to know if public perception has changed about this movie since we last saw it, because I know it was very exciting for everyone to see this movie. Mm-hmm. But I wonder, you know, after that excitement wears off, after this movie becomes a fact of life and is the third highest grossing animated movie of all time. I finally got it out. I said it. I wonder if it seems less special now. And I really want to know, have you reevaluated your thoughts? Have you decided that we were actually correct? I really want to know that. But Henry, can you take this first comment from Roger?
It felt like Mario through the lens of Hollywood-style humor rather than true Mario. The lamp shading that was mentioned on the podcast stood out to me. Seth Rogen giggling that Mario got the cat box, etc. I don't know. There was something very SNL about it. The games expressed themselves with a lot more earnestness than the movie. The cutscenes in Luigi's Mansion 3 have a more honest charm. I wish the movie had appreciated the material like that in an honest way without having to point out how silly it was. This is a difficult series to adapt. I think it might have been better to go a more abstract, focus on action like Andy Tartakovsky, or experiment with the visuals like Spider-Verse. Maybe stop motion. I think Stewart had mentioned Aardman. Also, it might have been more creative if a Japanese studio made it, though I guess Nintendo really wanted to make a Hollywood movie rather than a Japanese one. I mean, yeah, like but all of those examples are great examples. Those movies make less money than Minions movies, and it is, other than Barbie, no movie made more money this year than Mario.
Yes.
Yeah.
I didn't realize. So Barbie is like the number one movie of this year?
Yes, wow. Currently, yeah. It goes Barbie, Mario, Oppenheimer. Those are the top three.
Wow, what a sandwich that is. I agree with people at the time where they were saying, you know, even if you don't like how it's written, it's a visual spectacle, and I think, like, yes, within the terms it's setting, it looks very good. The things it's rendering are very pleasing to the eye. But there, I feel like there's no style to the movie, especially because this movie came out. And then I saw... okay, so Henry, you would know this. It's not Into the Spider-Verse. Or is it Into the Spider-Verse?
Across the Spider-Verse is the second one.
Okay, yes. Yeah. Stop naming your movies like that. Just call it two. Just call it two. But yes, I saw the second Spider-Verse movie. And I was like, wow. Oh, anime movies can look like this. So awesome. I'm like glued to the screen for 2.5 hours. What am I going to see next? And then the Ninja Turtles movie comes out. I like that even more. Like, wow, this looks like a scuzzy 90s cartoon, but with like this great visual fidelity to it, this great sense of style. And Mario just looks like it pales in comparison. And now Mario Wonder is out, and I think there's more interesting visual stuff happening there than in the Mario movie. It's not as far as I want them to go, mm-hmm. but it's still a big step up. So I feel like while competent, while pleasing and colorful, anime movies are advancing so much now that Mario, you can't really even say like, oh, it's like the best looking animated movie. I feel like it's hitting the bar it needs to hit, but it's not trying anything new.
Also, it's funny he mentions, or the comment Roger mentions, like Seth Rogen giggling through it. It's like, the Turtles movie was executive produced by Seth Rogen. I think as far as famous dudes who do these adaptations of kids' cartoons now, he's one of the better ones. Like, he also works on the Invincible Amazon show, and the second season is out now, but it's not airing yet when we're recording this. But the first season was really great, too. Like, he is one of the better... If any rich jerk who doesn't know how to draw gets to executive produce animated movies, he's the one who should be doing it.
Yeah, so, I mean, maybe it's because I recently moved to Vancouver, but now I feel like I'm begrudgingly respecting Seth Rogen, and it scares me. Maybe he's okay. I mean, I could change my mind, but, you know, he's doing good stuff right now. Mm-hmm. So we have, who's the next person here?
Oh, Blake
we have
R.
Blake R, who says, everything about the movie has been said verbatim in terms of criticisms and praises, so my two cents will be that it took me out of it a bit to hear Scott Menville as a random Koopa who speaks out against Bowser. He's such a great VA, but all I hear is Kevin French when he's not doing his Robin voice. This is Bob speaking. I agree, because we just covered, actually it's been a year. We covered Paranorman, a great animated movie, by the way, about a year ago on our podcast network. Scott Menville has a very small role as a deputy in that movie, and it's just like, well, that's Kevin French. That's just Scott Menville's voice. If you look up Scott Menville, he looks nothing like what you think he does, by the way. Mm-hmm. But that is just what comes out of his mouth, and it's unmistakably the Kevin French character that I associate that voice with.
I think of him as a dweeb like Kevin French, not a jacked goateed man.
Yes. I guess maybe when you sound like Kevin French naturally, you have to go the other direction in terms of what your body looks like, just to prove people wrong.
I wonder if that was like a favor to, not a favor exactly, but how that, you know, in cases like this, longtime voice actors like that help a ton in the making of the movie, providing temp voices, and then as a gift to give you a little extra money and, you know, residuals for a long time. They're like, well, okay, you gave us the guideline of how to animate this character, but you're not in the movie, so here's two lines and you'll get paid forever in residuals from this movie.
And you'll really stand out.
Yeah.
All the Mission Hill fans will be hooting in the audience. But yeah, Henry and I are the same way. When we hear Scott Menville, we think of Mission Hill immediately. Henry, what does Mark say? He's the next guy in our comments here.
Disappointing they use the aha version of Take On Me when we all know Donkey Kong canonically is a big ska fan and prefers Real Big Fish's version. Absolutely.
Well, you know, Mark, you're not thinking like an executive. Yep. And honestly, the original version tests better with the demographic that they're targeting. So you're a moron. I'm kidding, Mark. I would actually prefer the Real Big Fish version, because that's the one I played a lot of with Samba de Amigo, the Dreamcast game. That was in that game. And, of course, we all remember it in basketball, right?
Right. God. That's right. Everybody,
Real Big Fish was like the house band for the basketball team.
They're
in
playing
that movie.
Live in the movie so much. They're really in that movie. Yeah.
Yeah.
But no, I wish it was. That would have been a slightly creative choice instead of just like, no, it's the aha song you've heard used 8 trillion times in everything. And at least a cover would make it a little fresher. But again, it, like you said, Bob, they're not doing this to be fresh. They count on, like, everybody knows Take On Me. It makes people happy to hear it. We're playing the hits. That's the point of using it.
Yeah, I mean, the song rules. I mean, you don't need me to tell you that, but now I'm going to forever associate with Donkey Kong driving around for no reason.
I hate that it starts to with the shades being flicked out. I thought that was lame. Like,
yeah. Again, let us know if you reevaluated this movie. So we have more in our Mario Brothers punishment zone. So I guess I'm next. Paul says, I think there is value to a film that literally asks nothing of the viewer. It's honestly kind of novel. Every movie wants to evoke some kind of emotion or surprise. And honestly, it's kind of annoying sometimes. This movie, you can just look at pretty moving images, and it doesn't try to tell you to feel any emotions or even think about the punchline to a joke. Sitting still for 90 minutes and for the first time in decades having absolutely nothing required or expected of you, that is art. Nicole Kidman wants me to believe heartbreak feels good in a place like this. I believe that nothing feels even better. Now, I want to say that Paul's comment is dripping with sarcasm.
No.
But hey, you know what? As a 90-minute screensaver, Mario Brothers movie could be fun. If you're very high, perhaps, maybe it's fun to look at the colors,
so
and maybe
colors.
You look at your hand afterwards and think about, what is Donkey Kong really like in real life?
Yeah, I mean, this is why your 6-year-old child loved it and why everybody defended it with that. Like, I mean, yes, there's worse. We've said it a million times, but yeah, that's a great point of like, when people say their kid loved it, and I'm sure your kids do love it. Kids, and I love your kids. Your kids, I'm sure, are great. But, you know, it doesn't make it necessarily a good movie just if a 6-year-old likes it, you know?
And actually, our next comment is related to that topic, Henry. What does friend of the show Drew Mackey have to say?
Mm-hmm. And Mario Expert. I like the movie more than the average person on this episode, but you people using your children's joy as a justification for a thing being good are confounding to me. I've seen children play with cardboard boxes. I've seen them play with rocks. One time I saw a kid on purpose mash his hand onto a cactus to see what the spines would feel like. Your children are not awesome, and they have bad judgment.
Yes, I would compare watching this movie to mashing my hand on a cactus, honestly.
Well, because when you saw the poster or the trailers, you knew what this movie was. Just like when you look at a cactus, you know what a cactus is. It's pointy and sticky.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I mean, I like Drew has a point here. When I go to a movie, I'm paying for my own joy. I'm not paying for a child's joy. That's not my job. I'm not raising this kid. I'm paying to experience joy myself, and I received none from this movie. But it's okay if your kids liked it. Mm-hmm. But they kids are not reviewing movies, and if they are, they're on some YouTube channel I don't watch.
Maybe kids everywhere are begging their parents to turn on Peacock to watch Mario all the time on it over and over again. Instead of the Mario DVD, they're asking to turn on Peacock over and over again.
Well, I know. I've heard through the grapevine that kids love the Peaches song that Bowser sang.
I know, right? I'm scared. I feel like I have to look it up now that I've said it. I feel like on the first weekend, it was at like 5 million views on YouTube. I got to look it up now, but...
Okay. I mean, I'll say that I'm not going to disparage the children of the world, but when I was your age, I was into Weird Al, and I think he's a lot more inventive than Jack Black improvising a mildly amusing song about Princess Peach.
Yeah.
I've said enough. I'll leave it there.
Okay. So the official music video has 89 million views, and the Jack Black live action version of it has 54 million views.
I guess in terms of YouTube, that's pretty popular, but it's not like Gangnam Style popular yet.
Okay, sure. It's not. None of them have passed 100 million, but I mean, combined that. Oh, and then just the Peaches song that's not even a video, just the song is 32 million.
Okay. Boy, yeah, I guess so. I guess over 150 million people maybe are into this song, but
yeah.
Maybe we're the wrong ones. But again, we're reevaluating this. It's been 6 months. We've all had time to heal. Let's move on to what Shay says. And Shay says, finally, a podcast where I don't feel like I'm going insane. This movie felt more like a commercial for products I already own than an actual movie. Bob's point about not needing to feel validation for my consumerism is particularly salient, especially because I am sure that this is where all the goodwill from gamers has come from. I would love to hear the perspective of someone who has children on this podcast one day. As a parent myself, I have had to balance my daughter's media intake and would love to hear the thoughts of others who are in a similar role. Unfortunately, that is not in the cards for me, Shay. I believe out of all the Retronauts, Diamond has children, and I believe Kevin has a little baby, but you'll have to ask them.
Podcasting and parenting is a hard thing to balance, as I've seen out there, you know. So.
Yes, I deliver a baby 2 to 3 times a week into the wild here.
I'm curious. I've seen other parents who go like, yeah, look, I didn't care for much either, but my kids loved it. I did mean to mention about Drew as well. He is such a big fan of Spike from the Wrecking Crew game, that the second he had the cameo in it, that was the first messages I sent to Drew about it. Like, look, I don't care what you think about the Mario movie. Just tell me, what do you think about seeing Spike in the movie?
We talk about Spike on our upcoming Bowser podcast. Stay tuned. It's happening in about a month.
and Tashmon says about that same movie, it's weird. I agree with so much of what y'all are saying in terms of the Mario movie lacking depth in story and character arts, but I strangely left the theater in a more positive state than y'all. I think it's a testament to how strong the visuals and soundtrack were. I think the artistic team carries this movie hard, and I feel like I need to push back on the no one cared mentality a few of the hosts had. It's not as visually inventive as Spider-Verse or anything, but I was captivated by the many, many action set pieces. I get that the jokes are kind of lame and the characterizations are a bit all over the place, but there are plenty of other movies I can watch that stimulate the part of my brain that wants intellectually challenging art. The movie is spectacle first and a movie second, and I think it works really well as said spectacle.
Well, I will say that a few of us on the podcast were a little more extreme with our opinions. Perhaps somebody whose name rhymes with Gewert Stip, maybe?
That's too obvious.
But we all know what the Stewart experience is. So I think we were all prepped for that.
No, I mean, I do think it is visually very pretty. I do think it has a lot of pretty, like colorfully very pretty. And I do think there's some action bits like, oh, that's really good. Especially like the big show-offy long shot of Mario and DK powering up and running all the way to Bowser. I thought that looks really good, and so does the Mario Kart scene. That's what they're called in movies.
It's kind of a stage in a way.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, It's not a movie for everybody, but it kind of should be as a Mario movie, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Just sort of like how the Mario games are kind of for everybody. But maybe, there's going to be another movie. There's going to be several of these movies. They can't not make another movie. This movie made over $1 billion. So let's see what they improve upon. I'm willing to give the next movie a chance, mostly because I can see it for free and expense the ticket to the podcast and then make a podcast about it.
Mm-hmm,
but
mm-hmm.
I'm really curious to see, like, can you do anything more? Will you listen to the criticism? You don't have to, but I'm just curious.
I hope they have the guts to try something. At the very least with, like, the DK movie, maybe even Seth Rogen can use some of his star power to be, like, an EP on that movie and try to get something a little more creative in it.
Yeah, let's also recast Cranky Kong. I don't need a tired Fred Armisen voicing him. He should bring a little more to the role, I think.
He's only getting paid so much.
So our final comment is from Normally Retro, who says in this very succinct comment, "I like the movie. I like you all." And you see, that's the way to listen to a podcast. Mm. If you disagree with something someone is saying about media, you could just say, well, you know, it takes a lot of fruit to make Fruit Cup, or whatever Kevin French said in Mission
right.
Hill.
Yeah.
But yes, thank you for... I'm always happy when people can disagree with us and be diplomatic. Mm-hmm. And I know we have a great audience, and I always like to see that. So I feel like 99% of the comments that disagree with us on this topic were diplomatic, even though we were having fun and maybe being a little mean at times mm-hmm. about this movie. Yeah. That regardless of what we said... made $1.5 billion. So our opinions honestly don't matter when it comes to this movie at all.
And hey, if you spend Thanksgiving or any other holidays with the family, turn on Peacock and watch Mario together and see if you really still feel those positive feelings for it on the small screen on a second viewing. I feel like a second viewing is going to feel a lot longer than the first viewing on that movie.
Yes. Actually, since I saw the movie, this happened months ago, but I met some new people. I hung out at their place and I saw, like, oh, they have all this cool video game stuff. And on their shelf, there was a copy of Mario Brothers movie in 4K, like, displayed proudly. And I thought, like, I'm just going to let bygones be bygones and be friendly. So, I mean, if I can do it, you folks at home can do it, I think. Agree to disagree. That's my philosophy.
Yeah.
And that is the end of this episode of Retronauts, folks. Thanks for listening. This episode is brought to you by all of the great fans out there. And if you want to subscribe and support the show, please head on over to patreon.com/retronauts. For $3 a month, you can get all these episodes 1 week ahead of time and ad-free. But you really want to sign up for that $5 level, because at that level, you get 2 full-length bonus episodes every month. And we've been doing this for nearly 4 complete years now. So there's a lot of episodes you haven't heard if you're not a patron. You can do the math yourself, but I think it's close to 100 at this point. But yes, we just talked about the Mario RPG remake. We did an episode about Mario RPG to kick off that entire exclusive miniseries. That entire exclusive podcast series that's going on behind the paywall at patreon.com/retronauts. And at the $5 level, you also get a weekly column and podcast by the Great Diamond Fight. So if you enjoy hearing us and you want to support us, you get a lot just for $5 a month to support the show. So check it out at patreon.com/retronauts. And Henry, what's going on? We do a lot of things together, I've heard.
Oh, quite a lot. And that's all on the Talking Simpsons network of podcasts. Me and Bob started it off with the Talking Simpsons podcast, which we are now in season 14 of The Simpsons, while also covering the 10 years previous season 4 episodes, bouncing back and forth of those in chronological order. We are the PhDs of Simpsonsology. You will learn everything there is to know about an episode of Simpsons if you listen to that. It's Talking Simpsons Podcast, wherever you find podcasts. As well, we do a ton of extra podcasts, like our monthly What a Cartoon podcast, covering animated series super in-depth. And on our Patreon, which funds it all, if you go to patreon.com/talkingsimpsons, you get a ton of bonuses, like every month a new episode of Talking Futurama and Talking of the Hill, of us covering those series super in-depth, just like Simpsons, and our super premium podcast, What a Cartoon Movie, where we're about to do one of our rare non-cartoon movies, but it's cartoon in a way, The Muppet Christmas Carol. And you know what? Who knows? Maybe next year we'll do the Super Mario movie. I don't think so.
I'm shaking my head. Please,
yes,
please.
No.
At some point, when it's a classic, we'll cover it, I think.
Yeah.
When we're in our 60s. How about that?
Well, there's the 20-year retrospective on it. We'll do it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And also on social media, follow me at HENEREYG.
And as for me, you can follow me everywhere on social media. Just look for Bob Servo. I'll be there. I'm even on Blue Sky. Maybe I'll start skying it up over there. And hey, you know, the holidays are approaching, and I'm sure the gamer in your life needs a book to read, because we should all be reading more. And if that's true for you, check out my Boss Fight Books volume about Day of the Tentacle. I put together a huge oral history on that classic point-and-click adventure game for its 30th anniversary, and you can find that wherever you find books, or go to bossfightbooks.com to order a copy for yourself or a loved one. And that is it for this episode of Retronauts. We'll see you again very soon for another brand new episode. Take care.